You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, March 22nd, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Wednesday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Chris Lehman of The Baffler joins us. We're talking about whether or not intersectionality is a religion. We're going to be mocking Andrew Sullivan and talking about more silly campus debates. And Pyra Gomali, veteran journalist, peacemaker, Joseph Moakley Professor of Peace and Reconciliation at UMass Boston, is going to be talking about the legacy of Martin McGuinness, IRA fighter, political operative, peacemaker. He died two days ago in Ireland at the age of 66. We'll discuss his legacy and prospects for reconciliation in global conflict zones. Neil Gorsuch continues to Mr. Rogers his way through his confirmation hearings. He's incredibly disingenuous. But are any Democrats laying a glove on him? Well, a few did. We'll get to that. Mitch McConnell still going to move with breakneck speed to pass Ryan Trump GOP, make healthcare awful, the worst healthcare bill through the Senate. And is he signaling that he's already banking on a loss? That is, whether or not the House will even get the healthcare bill out itself. Some new sound on that. Not a good bill. People not happy. And in Europe, it looks like Germany might have found the answer for a genuine, reinvigorated center-left politics with a new leader taking that country's Social Democratic Party to its first lead in the polls in about a decade. And he's doing it by being charismatic and criticizing neoliberalism. Doesn't seem that hard. What is hard is being Secretary of State. Rex Tillerson, or Wayne, whatever the hell his real name is, did not want to do it. Wife forced him. But she's not going to force him to speak to the press or meet with NATO, because he's going to China. Thank you very much. Paul Manafort, well, he at least had a proposal to make several million dollars a year to push the Putin agenda. All that and more on today's Majority Report. I want to thank listener Mark, really great man, who gave me the shirt I'm wearing today. Black Panther shirt. He spent time with the Panthers in Oakland in their prime. Wanted me to have it. I appreciate the gift immensely. Thank you. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropping tomorrow. And yesterday we talked on a new one. We talked about Banksy's new hotel in Palestine, branding and social justice, all that and more. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a podcast on iTunes. Now, I am of the belief that, of course, Democrats should have done everything to not have Neil Gorsuch even have a hearing. I think that they should walk out en masse. They all should deliver opening statements the way Senator Sheldon Whitehouse did, which is like, hey, look, you're an extreme ideologue. You're the product of a corporate infrastructure which is distorted profoundly, democracy and accountability in every aspect of this society, and you're there to pass 5-4 extreme far-right decisions that will roll back voting rights, workers' rights, women's rights, and make the country more and more firmly in the mold of 21st century feudalism and Merrick Garland, Merrick Garland, Merrick Garland, Merrick Garland, goodbye. But They are having these hearings. And here is Senator Chuck Schumer saying on the Senate floor that it is, quote unquote, unseemly for the process to be moving so quickly with Gorsuch, given the cloud hanging over the Trump administration. Let's play this clip. I'll give you my review after.
Before I move on to another topic, I'd like to point out that it is the height of irony that Republicans held this Supreme Court seat open for nearly a calendar year while President Obama was in office, but are now rushing to fill the seat for a president whose campaign is under investigation by the FBI. Even Rep. Nunez, the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said the investigation, confirmed yesterday by FBI Director Comey, puts a big gray cloud over this administration. You can bet if the shoe were on the other foot and a Democratic president was under investigation by the FBI, the Republicans would be howling at the moon about filling a Supreme Court seat in such circumstances. After all, they stopped a president who wasn't under investigation from filling a seat with nearly a year left in his presidency. It is unseemly to be moving forward so fast on confirming a Supreme Court justice with a lifetime appointment while this big gray cloud of an FBI investigation hangs over the presidency.
How about not unseemly? How about borderline criminal? How about they stole a Supreme Court seat and now they're going to appoint a far-right radical ideologue to overturn decades of progress in every area of American life? I mean, it's optics, but especially when you have no actual power, optics really matter. And the words you choose really matter. And I think in some ways Schumer there is distilling to an essence the problems with the Democratic response under his leadership, at least in the Senate. You have people like Sheldon Whitehouse, Bernie Sanders, making structural critiques of everything from the fraudulent judicial philosophy that propels someone like Neil Gorsuch to the entire macro assault of the whole Republican agenda on over 99% of the population. Then you have this odd fusion of it's unseemly, which is an incredibly mild way of describing political warfare. And then at the same time, we just point back again just to the Russia stuff, which again, I've said a million times, it's totally valid to investigate. There is, at the very least, the very real possibility of something there, but it's not the whole game. So, you know, Chuck Schumer demonstrating once again that his communication shop is filled with Clinton alums.
Just to push back a bit and to argue for Chuck Schumer, I think it does.
Oh, well, thank you, young man. I appreciate it.
I think he does sort of lay the groundwork here for them leaving that seat open. Like, we're not going to get all the senators to come on board to fight the Trump's economic agenda to stop this nomination go through. So if you can use one of these issues, Benghazi-like, if you want to use that metaphor again, to get everyone else on board, you know, I'm kind of okay with it.
Well, we'll see. Maybe that'll work. Maybe Russia is the glue that binds Joe Manchin and Bernie Sanders. That's a, hopefully you're right. Okay, we're going to be right back with Chris Lehman of The Baffler on the Majority Report.
Surely a time will come, as in heaven, as in
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Chris Lehman. He is the editor-in-chief of The Baffler. His book, The Money Cult, is coming out in paperback, I believe, in May. Go back to our archives to listen to a conversation with him about The Money Cult book. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Michael. How about yourself?
I'm doing as well as can be expected today's
that,
world.
That goes without saying.
Right.
Days,
I guess it would be a little sociopathic to be like, oh, I'm great.
Exactly.
That's sort of a good way to start, actually, because you have a new piece out called The PC Debate Sullied, Andrew Sullivan and the Intersection of Mad and Lib. This is a fascinating conversation. This whole sort of like weird obsession about PC culture and buzzwords and this notion that, you know, college campuses are overrun with students who can't deal with opposing ideas and all of this stuff.
Baby Stalinists.
Baby Stalinists who are, you know, they would be able to create like a mass purge if they weren't so upset by seeing like a rerun episode of like Saved by the Bell or something, which they decide like promoted
exactly.
rape culture or something.
Yeah,
so,
and what's fascinating to me about this line of argument, because I'm old, is, you know, we had a mid-90s, you know, moral panic about political correctness on college campuses already, which is sort of how I backed into the writing about Andrew Sullivan for my Baffler column. And, you know, if you actually sit down sort of critically and do the math here, it would make sense, right, that all the 90s, PC zealots have now matriculated and presumably, because they all came from Ivy League campuses, graduated to their duly appointed place in key positions of power. So for the critique to be true, there would have to be some evidence that whatever, Wall Street, Hollywood, the media are all, you know, running amok with crazed, you know, hard left, you know, Marxist identity politics ideologues.
Right.
Call me crazy. Right. But I don't see them at Goldman Sachs or at Paramount or at CNN.
Yeah, the only filter down effect was maybe people realized at a certain point that like, hey, maybe we shouldn't use certain words, or maybe it's not a horrific idea if a gay person works at our company, which are, you know, exactly like those are good things, which is, it seems like it's a very weird thing to have to remind everybody of that, but it's very relevant
in
today's world.
That a lot of what gets derided as political correctness is kind of politeness.
or some basic evolution of society.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me about this is you took this sort of thing that happened at Middlebury a couple weeks ago, which I have not commented on. I haven't wanted to comment on with Charles Murray.
Yeah.
And a lot of kind of circles, you know, loop here, because Andrew Sullivan back in the same 1990s helped, you know, popularize the racist pseudoscience of the Charles Murray's bell curve. And then, you know, he was at Middlebury. And, you know, I guess just take us from there. Explain what happened at Middlebury.
Yeah,
and why
Andrew's
so freaked out.
It is general. Again, being old, I've organized many college protests in my time, and those protests can get out of hand, can get rowdy, can get stupid. Mm-hmm. College students are prone to all of those behaviors, right? And I would say, you know, there is no percentage really in defending a lot of the conduct of the individual students at Middlebury. Though I think, you know, they were, and even Andrew Sullivan sort of concedes that Murray's work lends itself to exploitations by bigots and racists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's good, you know, it's healthy in any democratic setting, including college campuses, to call out racism and bigotry and ideological enablers of those practices. But what caught my eye in Sullivan's column, which ran at New York Magazine, where I worked long ago, was that he somehow got it be in his bonnet that this all had to do with an idea called intersectionality, right. Which actually a friend of mine and a contributor of a great piece in the Baffler that I'm now working on, Kim Crenshaw, law professor at Columbia and UCLA, originated to just further the simple idea that, look, you know, when we talk about these kind of monolithic structures of oppression like patriarchy and capitalism and white supremacy, we should remember that in real life, they affect, you know, individual targets in a multiple fashion. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you know, you can't just, you know, wage a war against patriarchy and forget that many of its victims are black or people of color.
Right.
That seems, on the face of it, not a very controversial claim and one that deserves, you know, a fair hearing. And Kim is an incredibly accomplished intellectual who has, you know, outlined her ideas in great nuance and detail. But what Andrew Sullivan did was he sort of looked at the idea of patriarchy, intersectionality, which I don't think he has bothered to read any further about, and decided this is a religion.
Right.
these people have gone crazy with the idea that they're going to enforce, you know, what he, quoting Orwell, calls a smelly orthodoxy, and read everyone who dares to dissent from the intersectional gospel, you know, out of public life, including Charles Murray, including Murray's staff interlocutor at Middlebury, including the American Enterprise Institute chapter that sponsored Murray's appearance. And this is like crazy talk. I'm sorry, it's hard for me to describe it any other way, especially when you realize that, you know, Sullivan's rhetorical position here is that, you know, we need to give a fair hearing to Charles Murray's ideas. And he proceeds to then vandalize the intellectual work that Kim Crenshaw has done based on, you know, exactly the kind of, you know, kind of crude caricature that he is professing to combat in his column.
It's mind bending, and I don't think, from my experience, it's not atypical of Sullivan's work. But what's
And in fact, what, you know, sort of the background here is critical race theory, which is the intellectual movement that Kim Crenshaw helped found, was a big bête noire of Andrew Sullivan's New Republic in the 90s, and he published many hit pieces targeting the idea and other exponents of it, like Charles Oakley at Harvard. It just seemed like a good moment to sort of step into this and say, like, well, who's really being the intolerant, you know, enforcer of a smelly orthodoxy here?
Yes, no, exactly. And I think that's, you know, there's a number of things that I want to, get to in the next couple of minutes. But I think what's interesting to me is that you have a couple of different versions of this conversation going on. One is that, and what seems to get missed in a lot of it, is that if you go back to Kimberly Crenshaw's original work, I mean, it's very rigorous, it's very sound, and as you say, it's basically just pretty sensible. It's just basically saying you need to have an integral analysis of all of these variables interacting with each other. So capitalist exploitation affects everybody, but it's going to affect a woman of color who works in a specific industry differently than, you know, somebody else. This is very basic stuff, right? It's and very sound, but also very, very. And so you have, I think it's very weird because you have, on one hand, still, as you were making the point earlier, overwhelmingly in the culture. And it's amazing on some level that we even have time to write pieces like this with Trump as president, that, you know, we are not even remotely at the point of digesting, let alone actually legislating or implementing ideas that could address these crises. We're actually in an age of resurgent overt white supremacy.
Right.
I'll concede that I think that there is you know, certainly the way Hillary Clinton's campaign, as an example, kind of bastardized this stuff. And, you know, people used these kind of, I call it like knockoff intersectionality or Walmart intersectionality right. to, you know, all right. of a sudden like, well, you know, Bernie supports universal health care and that means it's universal. Right, so he's erasing identity. So now all of a sudden we need to have another trade agreement with Asia or you're racist. You know, that kind of nonsense has definitely come out. And then you have, you know, this sort of continuum of people. Sullivan is the prime example, but also someone like Jonathan Chait, who are engaging in these great acts of projection, because on one hand, they're sort of like, oh, you know, it's so terrible that we can't have these rigorous open exchanges, but any rigor applied to an analytic understanding of these issues freaks them out. And I guess the two ironies that I just want you to comment on to connect those three threads are that one hand, the most obvious is that from a societal power perspective, these ideas are still very much on the margins. And then that number two, it's very odd because some of these people kind of dance back and forth. Like, you know, Jonathan Chait will sort of get all nerdy about we need to have open ideas. But then at the same time, you know, actually seem kind of comfortable with the sort of bastardized arguments if it was in the service of knocking Bernie Sanders. So you have an outlet like New York Magazine, which plays these dual roles of, on one hand, oh my God, these kids are destroying all of our conversations. And then at the same time, like, hey, you know, I heard that that guy doesn't like girls. So he is a horrible misogynist.
No, it is, you know, the common thread, I think, in what writers like Chait and Sullivan are up to is a kind of boundary policing, right?
Right.
Which again is a paradox because they claim to be promoting, you know, free inquiry and resisting, you know, any kind of, you know, what they think is an authoritarian tendency on the left. And yet you're right. I think there's a sense in which if you were, you know, like a Bernie supporting feminist, let's say, you don't really exist in the world of Jonathan Chait.
Right. Right.
And again, the paradox here is that's the very kind of complicated description of actually existing social reality that terms like intersectionality, which is not my favorite coinage.
I'll we say, should be intersectional, but not use the word.
Yes, that's a, that might be a good, Kim would probably disagree, but, but I think what you see is this, you know, what it translates to, and this was the New Republic's de facto mission statement throughout Andrew Sullivan's career, I think, was that in contrast to the old slogan of there are no enemies on the left, in a sense for these people, there are only enemies on the left. And it's deranging at a time like this when I think there is, you know, obviously the Trump phenomenon, among other things, has dramatized very forcefully the need to have a true left kind of united front that is organized around, you know, universalist ideas like, say, you know, truly universal healthcare or universal college access or universal, you know, basic income. And so the activity of Chait and Sullivan and company in this sphere seems perverse.
It is perverse, and it's also...
And it's weird because I reviewed Charles Murray's last book for the New York Observer back when the New York Observer was more defensible. And
did Kushner like your review?
I remember because it came out right after the 2008 meltdown, and my lead was something to the effect of like, you know, here we are in this, you know, tremendous economic calamity. People are, you know, losing their retirement funds, their homes. It's a colossal, you know, moment of reckoning, and who on earth has the luxury or the time to devote to like traditional culture war themes? And then my response was, well, Charles Murray does, of course.
Yeah, of course.
he's discovered that, you know, what ails, this was actually a book about the white working class called Coming Apart. And, you know, what he did after literally like finding his analysis on nothing more than the works of Richard Florida and David Brooks, which is, you know, the equivalent of using a consumer lifestyle catalog as a primary document, right?
Right, right.
He decided that the, you know, the white working class had lost morale, that it had, you know, it had decided that it didn't believe in the work ethic anymore. This, you know, again, after the 2008 meltdown, where the entire, you know, structure of capitalism was, you know, all but saying, you know, screw you.
Was revealed to be fundamentally flawed. No, I mean, yeah, that actually, right. You know, Chris, so, as a final question that loops with that perfectly, because unfortunately we're a little tight today, but I want to talk with you more. But that is it right there. Is it's the refusal to acknowledge, it's not, I mean, yes, okay, it can be obnoxious to drown somebody out and whatever, you know, that's a separate conversation. But this refusal to understand that there's a materialist motive for arguments, so that someone like Charles Murray is by definition not arguing in good faith, because his job is to be a corporate bagman, pseudo-public intellectual, and write justification for systemic obscenities and injustices through pseudo-social science. He's an apparatchik. And as soon as we're in the realm of like, well, you're drowning out his ideas, you're not recognizing that his ideas are just a marketing catalog for 21st century feudalism.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. So, yeah, and it is a weird, you know, whatever. I support it. It's weird to me that there are American Enterprise Institute chapters at these colleges where he's being sponsored. He's going to be speaking at Columbia next, and you know, it's fine. Let him speak. Let protesters come. All that, but. It does seem like there is a bigger institutional problem if we're talking about the American university as truly a site of free open inquiry and intellectual market of ideas, if the American Enterprise Institute is accepted as a principal enabler of that inquiry.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Because it's just PR and propaganda. Yeah. Chris Lehman, we should do this again. Editor in chief of The Baffler. The piece is The PC Debate Sullied, Andrew Sullivan and the Intersection of Man and Lib. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you, Michael, as ever.
Okay, great. Talk with you soon. All right. We will be right back with Parag O'Malley. We're talking the legacy of Martin McGuinness, terrorist, peacemaker, politician on the Majority Report.
Say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youth. I and I start recruit, soldiers for Selassie I army. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the Savior, welcome the Rasta youth. You're not for oxy's who, at the general issue in a warning. Job people, them a ball, said them tired of mediocre. Evil a go fall when we chat in Ethiopia. Believing from down, call them life not easy boat. Even Ban Khan said it's not an easy road. Operation, occupy the motherland. Calling all soldiers to kind of chat along. From creation, he writing a job plan. But chronics can't do it alone. So I'm recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, by choose. Executing Selassie I works and the Rastafari truth. And them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youth. I'm gonna start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the Savior, welcome the Rasta youth. You're not for oxes who are the general issue in a warning boy. Waving the banner red, green and gold. It is such a honor for season four. Discovered on stones and trees and scrolls. And even in the stories that Jesus told. Rasta youth must inherit the earth.
can't sit down, Jaja, send me for work. Bring the fire in around, Jaja, send me for
work. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Parag O'Malley. He's a journalist, peacemaker, John Joseph Moakley Professor of Peace and Reconciliation at the John W. McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Parag, I hope I got it right. Thank you so much for joining us from Dublin.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for having me.
So you are, as a journalist and as a person who has worked in reconciliation efforts globally, in fact, you've worked in Northern Ireland, you've worked in Nigeria, you've worked in Iraq. You have came across Martin McGuinness many years ago in the process of doing this work and helping facilitate what happened in Northern Ireland and in terms of conflict resolution. Before we get to more of the specifics, can you give just your kind of more, your sort of estimate and brief bio of Martin McGuinness, the man?
And Martin McGuinness was a very ordinary young person. He was born in Derry, Northern Ireland, in the 1950s. At that time, Derry was the only city in Northern Ireland with a Catholic majority. But because of gerrymandering, it was dominated and ruled by the Protestant pro-union minority. He was born in the Bogside, one of the poorest and most deprived Catholic areas in Derry, and he remained a Bogside man all his life. His first exposure to, say, violent oppression as distinct from the kind that comes from being under the thumb of an oppressive power came at the time of the civil rights marches, and in particular Bloody Sunday, when 14 civilians were gunned down by British paratroopers. And that was a radicalizing experience for many young people.
They were non-violently protesting, correct?
Yes, they were nonviolent, and it wasn't until the Seville Commission about 4 years ago that finally established the truth that there had been no provocation, as had been alleged in many reports over the years, that these were troops that opened fire, perhaps believing there were armed civilians, but nevertheless there weren't. But that was a radicalizing experience, and in the circumstances of Derry at that time, that meant street protests and the army reacting, stones being thrown, Molotov cocktails, and you coming from an area such as the Bogside, poor, deprived, under the thumb of the Unionists and now under the thumb of the British Army, who knew nothing about Northern Ireland and behaved the way all occupying Irelands do. It was very easy for him to become part of the IRA. Very easy. And many young people from the Bogside became members of the IRA. Many did not. Many went the nonviolent route, the route of John Hume, mm-hmm. and the Social Democratic and Labour Party. But for the members of Martin's generation who joined the IRA at that time, I don't think any of them at that point had any idea that this conflict would last as long as it did. But as in all conflicts, once the conflict begins and there is violence and counter-violence, there's a slow evolution of the conflict from one level of violence to a higher level. and that in turn generates a still higher level. And this is the kind of escalation that can turn local incidents of violence into national movements of violence.
What
McGinnis?
Go ahead.
No, McGinnis was from a humble background. He was an apprentice butcher, and from a family of seven. His mother was a staunch Republican, you would say not strident. But he did not grow up, like very few people did in Ireland, with the burning desire to take up arms and reunite Ireland. All of these things coalesced after the events of Bloody Sunday and the manner in which the civil rights marches across Northern Ireland were put down.
What made
and
him...
Of course,
I'm just curious, what made him, because he has this very, you know, ordinary background, as you've been emphasizing, but then first as an IRA operative and all that entailed, he rose up the ranks. And then when we get to the later part of his career, he actually proved himself to be a very effective politician. It's fascinating when you look at people who end up becoming global statesmen, who don't come from, you know, they don't have the typical pedigree that you would expect from most supposed statesmen. And in fact, most of the people with the typical pedigree aren't particularly impressive. But then some of these people who come from unexpected circumstances, both for good or for ill, turn out to be really exceptional at what they do. So what was it that made him sort of rise up the ranks, as it were, and then when did the sort of shift start to come when he realized that a kind of campaign of violence was not going to be effective?
Well, his exceptionality arose out of the fact that he was living in exceptional circumstances. His personality was a warm personality. He had a soft charm. He was a very self-disciplined person. You know, the Brits had him kind of monitored for years and they could get nothing on him because he was a good family man. He didn't smoke, he didn't drink, and he didn't womanize. And he was a staunch Catholic. It's his personality, and that personality was there from the beginning, but that personality had two tracks, and one side of that personality led him to believe that the only way he could, with others, rid Ireland of the oppressions that his community had endured since 1920 was through armed struggle. And of course, Ireland has a rich history of armed struggle. Indeed, our most venerated national hero, Michael Collins, who led the War of Independence from 1918 to 1921, was ruthless in his attacks on a British Army outposts, on anyone who worked for the British administration. IRA men would come to the door of civil servants in Dublin, knock on the door, and when the door was opened, they would just shoot whoever was there dead. So again, you've got to contextualize them in the history of Irish republicanism. And that history goes back to 1798, and it is configured by uprisings in 1803, a failed one, an uprising in 1847, a failed one, an uprising in 1867, a failed one, an uprising in 1916, a failed one, but one that did indeed arouse the people, and then the subsequent War of Liberation run by the IRA between 1918 and 1921. Now, the IRA never accepted the settlement of 1921. It made the status of Ireland as part of the Dominion, which the Queen was still the head of state, as in Australia or Canada. And the Republican side of the movement fought a civil war over that settlement, to be a republic or not to be a republic. Now, the IRA kind of disappeared into the shadows, but and by the time of Bloody Sunday and the time of the protests in Belfast, the IRA was irrelevant. You know, some estimates say that among people who associated themselves with the IRA in the early days of these uprisings, that there were only 4 or 5 guns in Belfast.
Wow.
And they were totally unprepared for it. They rode the crest of what was happening. They didn't create the crest. And one of the two turning moments, of course, was the arrival of the British Army. Mm-hmm. That even though it was welcomed by the Catholic community, who were afraid of a pogrom by the Protestant community, for the IRA, they became the new targets, the presence of a foreign power and a foreign army. And their actions against the IRA, against the British Army, and then the British Army's actions in return, again escalated from one level to another. And when the British brought in detention without trial.
And what years are we talking about now?
That would have been in the early late 1960s.
Okay, late 60s,
beginning of the
1970s.
Okay. When they introduced in detention without trial, it kind of solidified the Catholic community, because many of the people who were detained had nothing to do with the IRA, and many of the people in the IRA who might have been detained had prior notice that detention would be coming in and had fled the country. But one of the turning points was in the Falls Road in Belfast in 1971, I believe, when the Falls Road is the main Catholic drag in West Belfast. And the army sealed off the Falls Road, and they went house to house searching for weapons. Mm-hmm. And by the time they had finished that over a curfew of 36 hours, and they had turned every family on that road into a supporter of the IRA.
Right.
Because like all armies that come to search homes, they came in heavy equipment, heavy guns, pulled things apart, tore cupboards over, knocked furniture around, treated people in ugly fashion, wouldn't allow them to go to shops for food.
So,
and mistakes by the British initially was one of the factors that helped the rise of the IRA.
So I'm just going to give sort of summarize to give the context, and we'll move forward a bit. But you had a sort of dormant IRA in the 1960s, and you had the Bloody Sunday Massacre, which, what was the date of that again? That was in 19...
That would have been 71.
71, okay. So then you have this...
71. Mm-hmm.
So you have this sort of dormant IRA. It rebuilds, it reassembles itself, and then the British Army's occupation initially is welcomed by Catholics, because at the same time there's also Protestant loyalist paramilitaries operating as well. So people are afraid of mass killings of Catholics in Northern Ireland. But the British Army comes in and behaves
when it appeared in 1969 as though there really was going to be a pogrom by the Protestant community and Catholics, and the police had lost complete control of the situation. At that point, a decision was made in London to send in troops.
Right.
And when then troops arrived, probably like all troops, they thought they would be there for a couple of weeks.
Right.
They were there for 30 years.
Right. So then we have an intensified, you know, campaign from the 70s through the 80s. There's many stories, many accusations about what specific operations was McGinnis involved in or not, whether they were bombings, whether they were involved with, you know, potentially killing people inside the Northern Irish community who might have been perceived as informers. It's a very troubling history. At a certain point in the 1980s, maybe earlier, there was an attempt, but there's this real conclusion from the political leadership of the IRA and the military leadership that they need to, at the very least, follow a dual-track strategy of continue military operations, but also start negotiations. I want you to maybe explain that, and then if you could also get to when you show up in the narrative and the connection to South Africa, because the other thing that influenced McGinnis greatly was meeting with Nelson Mandela, meeting with veterans of the African National Congress that helped shift his thinking on a settlement and on reconciliation, the message coming from fellow revolutionaries?
Well, the history of that time is not fully written.
Right.
But there is no doubt that Martin McGinnis sanctioned the use of violence.
Right.
And he has never made an apology for that. And insofar as there were atrocities, as there were, he bears part of the blame of collective responsibility for those decisions made. He may not have made the decision, but he was part of the leadership that okayed those decisions. In the early 1990s, for the first time, a couple of things were beginning to happen. One, the IRA was slowly coming to the conclusion that it could never defeat the British Army. But at the same time, the British Army was coming to the conclusion that it could never defeat the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
So both sides recognized this kind of standoff and that you had a situation where you could have conflict in perpetuity with no winner, or you could try a negotiating track. And there were many subterranean negotiating tracks between the IRA and the British government right through the 1990s, even earlier. And they were in contact. IRA leadership was in contact with M15 and M16 and probably members of the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland through these various channels. And the IRA, after Bobby Sands had died of a hunger strike, after he had been elected to as an MP in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin shifted policies and began to contest elections.
That's the political arm of the IRA. Just for everyone to know.
And this, when it was called, the slogan was by the Armalite and the ballot box,
mm-hmm.
and they would unify Ireland. But of course, the Armalite and the ballot box ultimately are in contradiction to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And McGinnis, Adams, and others in the leadership, in touch with the British, began to feel the ground for negotiations. But before there could be a peace agreement, and this would be the contribution of McGinnis, that they had a constituency in Sinn Féin, North and South, that believed firmly in republicanism, that believed firmly that Ireland would only be united by the use of force, that the physical force was the only thing the British understood,
mm-hmm.
and that was a hallmark of the IRA's belief. he and Adams had to go to every Sinn Féin constituency in Northern Ireland and the Republic and convince them that a change in strategy was required and that negotiations were required, that a ceasefire was required, but that did not mean they were giving up their aspiration for a united Ireland, but they were accepting the fact that the violence alone would never achieve it. And if violence could not achieve it, it could only be achieved through negotiations. And McGuinness's contribution to that is that McGuinness has a personality that is a soft personality, immensely easy to relate to. Mm-hmm. He was looked up to all members of Sinn Féin because of his leadership in the IRA. And his word carried a lot of weight. And those constituencies throughout Ireland would never have agreed to negotiations. There would have been a rebellion had it not been for the impact that McGuinness in particular had during the conversations with those Cummins, with those branches of the IRA. And also, when he did enter negotiation, he was the lead negotiator for Sinn Féin, not Adams. Mm-hmm. He had again a personality that I've seen him in action. And he has a personality that knows how to negotiate. And in many cases, the best negotiators, it's a gift. Mm-hmm. It comes out of the personality of the person. Mm-hmm. It is something that cannot be taught. Mm-hmm. It cannot be taught on when you bring the opposition to a certain breaking point before you make a concession. It cannot be taught when you need to compromise or when you see an opportunity to compromise or when you see an opportunity to gain an advantage. Those things are intuitive. And he had that intuitive gift. And he brought his personality and his gifts as a negotiator to the negotiating table. And he was much admired, and Tony Blair, who was the brief prime minister at the time, says how well he says, I got on with Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness. I probably got on too well with them. And he recounts an incident of where they were in Downing Street, having been whisked over there, and he looks out the window onto his garden in Downing Street, and he sees McGuinness and Adams playing with his children. And they rush out to get the children out of the way because they think that there might be some photographer looming someplace who might get a photograph of this. He was relatable, mm-hmm. and he bought that relatability to not just the peace process, but when he became Deputy First Minister. And his relationship with Ian Paisley, who had denounced him as evil for 30 years, and that relationship was pivotal to the success of the peace agreement in its early years.
We're running up against it a bit, but I just as a final sort of thought before I want to maybe you were already on this track, but in the final moment or so you were talking. You said specifically because you wrote a very good piece in the Boston Globe that for McGuinness there was no lasting peace without forgiveness, and that this whole process and really the resolution of any horrible conflict where there has been serious abuses and human toll on either side, there is a need to sort of genuinely have that reconciliation process in order for something like the Good Friday agreements to hold. And I'm just wondering if you could speak in this last minute briefly to McGinnis's ability to forgive, maybe others' ability to forgive him. And with that, you know, his sort of passing and his particular imprint, you know, is this a stable settlement without his sort of personality in place in the and I know that's a lot, but take it away in the last minute or so.
Well, first, Michael, a peace agreement can occur without reconciliation. At that time, it's a frozen peace. It's a piece of paper. Reconciliation comes afterwards. Right. Reconciliation between the two communities, the Northern Ireland, the nationalist community and the unionist community, will take generations to achieve.
Right.
We're still only at the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
There's peace. There's a power-sharing agreement. There is more reconciliation among the elites, but among the populations in general, that kind of reconciliation has not occurred.
Right.
Two, what McGuinness brought to that power-sharing government was stability and a willingness to reach out to the other side. And one of the most touching things that has emerged in the last couple of days is that even up to the days before he died, he and Baroness Paisley, that's Ian Paisley's...
And just so everybody knows, Ian Paisley...
We're texting each other.
And Ian Paisley was the leader of the Protestant loyalists, very extreme on the other side, and arch enemies of the IRA and McGuinness for decades until, through the peace process, going into government together, they actually became genuine friends. And as you say, he was texting with Ian Paisley's widow up until just a couple of days before he passed away.
Yeah, so it was that friendship and the two of them together where they were seeing, enjoying each other's company and doing things together with no friction between them, but operating as a team, gave the initial stability that the agreement required. Gave that stability at the top that indeed the two most powerful figures on both sides were working harmoniously together and not working in friction.
Well, Parag O'Malley, I will link to the piece on majority.fm in the Boston Globe. I really, really appreciate your time on making sense of this legacy and how we achieve these really difficult settlements in a world of so many intractable conflicts. I hope you'll come back to America soon and help us in our disaster.
Anytime, Michael.
Okay, thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye. I just want to note really briefly, and I'm sure more information will come out on this when the show is released. But in London, outside of the House of Parliament, a police officer has been stabbed by an alleged assailant who was shot by armed police. House of Commons have been suspended. The Metropolitan Police are treating this as a terrorist incident. A car plowed into a crowd in Westminster Bridge, causing multiple casualties. And the Prime Minister was in the Parliament, apparently, at the time of the attack. Has there been any more information on this? Okay, I don't think there's any more information, but to some extent, we'll try to update you, but there's no doubt that later today we will know more about this. We want to just kind of get that on the record.
The only information I just got is that one woman died.
Okay, so there was a... that's terrible. Okay, subscribe to the Majority Report, like the Majority Report, Two Dope Boys at a Podcast, YouTube channel, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, or chocolate. Become a member. You know all that stuff. The phone lines are going to be on in a second, 646-257-3920. I am Zerardi on. See you in the fun half.